Right, well, thanks very much, Jane, for that introduction. So I've been deliberately provocative here with my title, and I'm going to continue to be so throughout the talk. And really to sort of set this in context, this is a Daily Telegraph from April of this year, and here it is on the, actually the headline, the story. False hope in hunt for genetic cures. And so this was based on an article by Steve Jones, who's their kind of science guru, and little comment, the evidence of genetic inheritance is clear, but the genes themselves are not there. So where am I coming from in this? And I think this whole area, it's quite a sort of political issue, isn't it? We all have a sort of axe to grind. And so my axe, if you like, is that I'm a clinical geneticist. I see patients and families in the clinic who want answers to questions affecting their health. And they want answers that give them certainty. They want sort of risks that mean something, not sort of vague, oh, it could be sort of 10% of this or that. And that's what I'm aiming to do in my work. This was actually on the sort of University of Oxford main website a week ago, because it so happened that we just discovered a specific gene that's involved in this facial malformation here. It's never been described before, so we actually had to give this as a new medical name. And the thing is, although it was a sort of press release, it basically generated very little interest indeed, even though it's a new medical condition. Because basically, if you haven't got this, you're fine. Why should you worry about it? But for the people who have this, it transforms them from a situation where basically they don't know what the diagnosis is, they don't know what the risks of having children affected with this condition are, which actually turn out we can say practically zero, because we know what the genetic mechanism is, and we can provide a genetic test. So this is the kind of genetics that I'm interested in, and that I think is good, but it's kind of, it's affected, it deals with rarities, and so therefore, to the general public, it doesn't affect you, it's not interesting. But I would like to make this point, and I'll come back to it, that people want answers to things. And the difficulty with a lot of what we're going to deal with today is we're talking about sort of risks varying a little bit. So this is really the first time I've talked about this field for a number of years. I got into it in the late 90s because I was involved in two working parties organised by the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, one of which was on mental disorders and one of which was on behaviour. So we had the problem in the late 90s of, there was this talk of all these genetic tests on the horizon, and would this affect the diagnosis of these disorders? And so I had to put quite a lot of thought into that at the time. And I ended up writing, as a result of that, this paper, which was devoted to behavioural disorders, in this wonderfully obscure journal. You see it up at the top, Studies in the History and Philosophy of Biological and Biomedical Sciences. Well, that really trips off the tongue, doesn't it? And consequently, this thing has almost never been read by anybody. but really what it addressed, as you can see in the title, is what are the limits to genetic prediction? And so back in 2001, remember this is orientated towards behaviour, I wrote in the abstract, the ability accurately to predict a person's actions would certainly have profound implications for notions of individuality and free will. But to what extent will the current explosion in genetic research provide more accurate predictors than have been available for millennia in the form of wealth, social status, and perceived family resemblance. The genetic research program is at too early a stage to answer this question with confidence, but various indicators tend to point in the same direction. The predictive ability of genetic analysis will generally be low. This conclusion runs counter to widely perceived populations. Now, I would suggest that nothing has changed from that over the past 8 years. Now, the exemplar that I took in this article for thinking about this problem, and I think it's really useful to think of specific examples, and this is still a brilliant specific example, is the association of polymorphism in the APOE gene with susceptibility to Alzheimer's disease. And the thing is, this is one of the earliest associations that was discovered, because it's a strong association. It's much stronger than all the stuff that's coming out of the recent genome-wide association scans. So if you can't make sort of clinical and individual use out of an association like this, you're going to have much more trouble with all the stuff that has sort of come out in the last couple of years. So the point is, there's this E4 allele of in this gene, which is present in frequency of 0.14. And so that basically means that about a quarter of people have got one copy of that, and about one in 50 people have got two copies of it. So that's obviously a lot of people in this room going to have it. And this has a major effect on your risk, of lifetime risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So that's down at the bottom there. The relative risk, if you've got an E4 allele, one E3 or 4 allele, increases it by 3.2, okay? Relative risk of 3.2, that is a huge relative risk compared with the stuff that's come out more recently, which is all below 2. And so, you know, this is a very strong predisposition to Alzheimer's disease. But nevertheless, despite that, 44% of people with Alzheimer's disease don't have this allele, and 71% of people who do have it don't develop Alzheimer's disease. So, it doesn't look, even though it's very strong, that useful. Now, you can quantify it much more accurately. And this was a really beautiful study published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1998. And I think, again, this may look a bit technical, but, you know, you have to sort of understand this to really understand what the problems are. So, this is what's called a receiver operating characteristic curve. And it can be applied to any sort of test you want to do. It doesn't have to be a genetic test. And what it's asking is, you know, for that test, as you start going through the population and you test more and more people, and you say, well, we think this one's going to have this, this one isn't, how good are you at picking out the ones who are going to have it? And obviously, you start off picking out the ones you're most certainly going to have it, and then as you go along, you get less and less certain. So a perfect test will basically pick out all the people who have this with no false negatives. So that's this point up at the top, all right? A test that's completely useless, or just as you test more and more people, well, you just sort of randomly either assign them correctly or either way. So really the test of any test is how what area, how good you are at getting up to that top left-hand corner as you test more and more people. So this specific study was looking at people with dementia, who've been diagnosed with dementia, and where some people with dementia have Alzheimer's disease and some have other causes of dementia like multiple little strokes. And then they've done post-mortems on these people after they died and said, well, did they actually have Alzheimer's disease or not? And so then what they've done is looked at how good the clinical diagnosis was. And so that's the dotted line. And so the area under the curve there is 84%. So another way of looking at that is if you took two people, one of whom actually had Alzheimer's disease and the other one didn't, then the question is, how good would you be at saying which one had Alzheimer's disease? The clinical diagnosis, 84%. The APOE wasn't quite so good, 80%. And then if you combine them, so this is the added value from this very, very strong predisposition, got you up to 87%. So it helped a bit, but not very much. And remember that these are actually people with already diagnosed with dementia. So this is a much more clear-cut situation than trying to use this to actually predict who's going to get dementia in the first place. So the other thing to remember about this, is these figures, 84%, 87%, because actually this is pretty good, as you'll see in a moment. So what's really led to the sort of explosion of interest in this field over the last couple of years? There's papers like this, and there's also lots of stuff, of course, done by DECODE themselves, who are scientifically absolutely superb out of it. And so this was work done mostly in the UK, the Wellcome Trust Case Control Consortium. And just in this one paper, in a number of different diseases, they say they've identified 24 independent association signals. So suddenly the companies are thinking, fantastic, you know, there are all these tests that we can start offering, just 24 from this paper alone. So then, but let's get into the nitty-gritty now. I'm sorry, this is a very busy slide, etc., but what we're talking about is sort of, you need really careful studies to dissect all this out. So, on the left-hand side here, we've got various diseases. Then the next column says clinical risk factors and how can we use those clinical risk factors to say how likely someone is to have the disease, all right? And so you get the area under curve for the clinical, which is here. So the thing to notice is that none of these, they sort of range from 0.6 to 0.82, none of them is actually as high as that Alzheimer's example. And then you ask how, if you put in all these SNPs that are known to be associated with the disease, how does that alter the area under the curve in the same way that we looked at ApoE and Alzheimer's disease? And what you can see is that it doesn't alter it very much, and it certainly doesn't alter it to the high levels that we've seen in the Alzheimer's example, which still isn't actually clinically useful. So the question is, will we get there just by finding more SNPs? And the problem is that this is a law of diminishing returns. With the genome-wide studies, what they've done is find the lowest hanging fruit that confer the highest relative risk. Almost all less than 2.0 per allele compared with the 3.2 of the APOE4 example. And so basically, as you add more alleles in, as shown here, you may sort of change the risks a bit. But what you do is just create a sort of a grey area. And it's important to remember, so this is basically a graph showing the number of risk alleles that someone might be carrying, and then the risk of the disease. But there are people who might carry quite a lot of risk alleles who still have a risk of the disease that's less than the mean. And then it's a question, well, which particular risk alleles has that company chosen to try and sort of peddle? It might just be that that person had a number of alleles which appeared to put them at a higher risk, when if you'd actually considered all the alleles, it might have put their risk down. So the thing is, although it's been, in some ways, you can say it's a fantastic scientific advance, this genome-wide association study, the amazing thing is that actually all these alleles that have been identified as associated with disease explain a tiny proportion of the heritability of the conditions under study, almost all of them less than 10%. So it's created this new sort of debate. Well, where's all the missing genetics? And that's where the Steve James article comes from. This was an excellent article published in Nature, which sort of put this question as a sort of detective story, the case of the missing heritability, and suggested various places where you might find it. And then here's another very good article by Mark McCarthy, who's in Oxford, who again sort of looks at this same question. And I mean, the current sort of thinking is that we know about Mendelian disease, where the penetrance is high, but the risk alleles are rare. And now, through genome-wide association studies, we know about the situations where the risk alleles are common, but the penetrance is very low. And maybe there's something in the middle, this so-called sort of dark matter, which would require much higher throughput sequencing strategies to find it. But I think the important point is, at the moment, the kind of tests for common diseases that are out there are rubbish, because we just don't know where most of the heritability actually lies. And so, then let's take it a stage further, because the thing is, there are actually some people out there who've had their whole genome sequenced. Basically, the two biggest egos in Craig Venter and Jim Watson. And so their papers published about their sequences. And you can't read all of this, but it doesn't matter because it's garbage. So this is Craig Venter's paper. And so this is a table showing, you know, various susceptibility alleles that he's got. Well, the thing is, it's easy to calculate that each of us carry at least 1,000 deleterious susceptibility alleles. All right, so what? And so this is some of the discussion that surrounds this sequence that they've got of him. So it says, well, he hasn't got Huntington's disease. Well, that's a big insight. And then it looks at various SNPs that are associated with cardiovascular disease, and so points out a couple of SNPs that are associated with cardiovascular disease. But then it points out that there's some other SNPs which protect from cardiovascular disease. So where does that lead you? And then it says on this other side, we've been able to detect inconsistencies between detected genotypes and the donor's DNA. And the expected phenotype based on the literature. For example, the donor's LCT genotype should confer adult lactose intolerance, according to published literature. In other words, he can drink milk. But this does not match with the self-reported phenotype of the donor's lactose intolerance. So, I mean, really, really, there's nothing useful came out of that at all as far as personalized genomics is concerned. Now, the other sequence, which was Jim Watson's, and I bet Craig Venter was really pissed off because this one was published in Nature. This raises, I think, as a clinical geneticist, a much more interesting issue, because what this pointed out was that Jim Watson is heterozygous for mutations in over a dozen genes, where if he'd been homozygous, or we'd had a child who was homozygous for those mutations, that person would have a very severe genetic disorder. And so that raises the question, which is something that was alluded to in the discussion, of maybe, you know, one thing that would be useful about personalized genomics would be identifying the carrier states for these rare conditions. But that's really only useful in relation to your partner, because unless you both carry the same disease allele, then there's really no risk for your children. And even that isn't quite as straightforward as it might appear, because, for example, looking at cystic fibrosis, which one in 22 of us in the audience carry, and it might seem a very sort of open and shut case that it was worth screening everyone for carriage of cystic fibrosis mutations. It turns out that it's actually putting that into practice isn't so easy, and that's because if people don't have experience themselves of that particular disease, and you go along and say, oh, you're at risk of having a child with cystic fibrosis, it doesn't actually mean a lot to them. Something else that amused me about this article is that it says, going back to the previous slide, Dr. Watson requested that all gene information about apolipoprotein E be redacted, citing concerns about the association that has been shown with Alzheimer's disease. So in other words, the one thing that might actually have been a predictive power, he didn't actually want to know about. And you know, that's because he's a human being. even good genetic tests may not be as good as they look. So this is the example of hemochromatosis, this is a recessive disorder, and due to mutations in the HFE gene, and it was identified by a company. It's quite common, and so it's thought they could make a lot of money because this is something you should screen the population for. So there's this very good study done by Boyfler and reported a few years ago, where they went out and looked at, you know, let's identify these mutations in a large population and see what their consequences for health are. So on the left-hand side, what you see plotted is the prevalence of these mutations in different age groups, with the mutant genotype on the x-axis and the normal on the y-axis. And what that shows is that there's no fall-off in the prevalence as you get older. So there's no suggestion in any of that data that actually this being homozygous for these mutations causes you to die early. And then, remarkably, they ended up finding 152 homozygotes for mutations in this gene. And only one of them, one of that 152, actually had signs and symptoms that would suggest a diagnosis of hemochromatosis. So it completely knocked that particular one flat. Total waste of time screening for it. So I'd just like to finish by sort of coming back to sort of two fundamental points. And this is just data from simple heritability studies saying, well, how much of a particular condition has a sort of genetic component? And you can look at this by looking at prevalence in relatives, in twins, and especially powerful is looking at twins where one gets adopted away. So this is comparing the black bars are monozygotic twins, so they're genetically essentially identical. Patch bars are dizygotic twins for a whole number of different sort of mental and other sort of physical diseases. And I mean, the heritability varies from 30 to 70%. But the point that I want to make here is remember that the black bars are monozygotic twins. So this is where they're genetically essentially identical. One of them has got the disease and the other one hasn't. So that's the absolute limit that you could ever make to any genetic test, because you identified all the genetic determinants of that one monozygotic twin. Well, the other one's got them as well, but they don't have the disease. And, of course, people love technology. It's great, you know, their new discoveries. Oh, yeah, let's have more genetic tests. I see this as it's a huge just sort of kind of distraction from, you know, these diseases. The really important components of them are in environmental. And this was a paper published in Science. You might possibly dispute the actual figures that they produced here. But saying that, you know, these four common diseases, colon cancer, stroke, coronary heart disease, diabetes, but basically something between 70% and 90% of these were preventable from simple environmental measures which are listed in the figure action. But that's really what we should be thinking about, and not fancy tests or using the latest genetic information. So anyway, I hope that's stirred things up a bit.